What does it take to succeed? This question has fueled a long-running debate. Some have argued that humans are fundamentally competitive and that pursuing self-interest is the best way to get ahead. Others claim that humans are born to cooperate and that we are most successful when we collaborate with others. In Friend and Foe, researchers Adam Galinsky and Maurice Schweitzer explain why this debate misses the mark. Rather than being hardwired to compete or cooperate, we have evolved to do both. In every relationship, from coworkers to friends to spouses to siblings, we are both friends and foes. It is only by learning how to strike the right balance between these two that we can improve our long-term relationships and get more of what we want, according to Galinsky and Schweitzer. Again, the name of their book is Friend and Foe. Maurice Schweitzer is the Cecilia Yen Koo Professor at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania, and a great pleasure to welcome him to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
How did the two of you come to the subject of friend or foe?
Well, we came to this idea from teaching negotiations. I've been teaching negotiations for about 20 years, and the idea that we're friends and foes with everyone emerged from the idea that in negotiations, we have interests that are aligned. We might both want to reach a deal or stay out of court, but we have interests that are in opposition. So I might want you to pay more money, and I might want to pay less money. And so we have to figure out how to navigate this balance. And as I began to think about this idea more, I began to realize that it pervades not just our negotiations, but it's really negotiations with a small n, that is the way we negotiate with our kids, the way we negotiate with our coworkers, our spouses, even our friends when we go out to dinner. We're constantly both collaborating and competing.
As I mentioned in the introduction, the book looks at when to cooperate, when to compete, and how to succeed at both. I'm curious as to where you think we are in that. Do we tend to give one short shrift and lean on one of those more than another?
Well, we have different proclivities for sure. That is, some of us look at the world as a very competitive place, and the way we see the world can often be a self-fulfilling prophecy. So if I start off competing with you, I'm likely to induce a competitive reaction from you. And so we might end up then competing. I think for most people, we often look for opportunities for cooperation. And I think one of the key insights in the book is that even in our most intimately cooperative relationships, we also have elements of competition, and we need to recognize that. And I think we can cooperate more effectively when we realize that our interests aren't always perfectly aligned.
When you look at those alliances and the fact that they aren't always perfectly aligned, is it a moving target, or if you're trying to attain something and then something changes and is that target still the target, or does it become something different?
Well, yeah. So I mean, our world is dynamic. Things are constantly changing, and so we need to reevaluate and reassess our relationships. So we might have a colleague that is a great collaborator, and then maybe new information comes out, and that might switch that person into a competitor. You can think about new information about salary information, or somebody gets a promotion, or there's an opportunity for promotion, and realize that only one of us might get it. New information can change us, or we find out that we actually have to compete with somebody else, and maybe the two of us, we were quarreling before, and then all of a sudden we become close and fast friends. I mean, for example, post 9/11, the United States and Pakistan became very, very close allies, where just weeks before, the U.S. and Pakistan were not close allies. We were much closer with India, for example, and you could see how just, you know, dynamic situations around us can move us both on the sort of geopolitical stage, but both sort of, you know, locally within our work and even at home.
You point out in the book that we tend to crave hierarchy. We like hierarchy.
Yeah, that throughout human history, every society in every part of the world has been characterized by hierarchy. It's just a fact of human nature. And it's not just human nature, animals also. So from packs of dogs to gorillas, you see hierarchy form. And I would argue that even when you think it's just a flat, no hierarchy environment, like going out to dinner, there's still a hierarchy that emerges even as you're going out to dinner. So who gets to pick the restaurant? Where do people sit? Who dominates the conversation? There's a hierarchy that naturally forms. And without it, we feel a little bit disorganized. And hierarchy enables us to coordinate our activities and enables us as a group to compete more effectively with other groups. So there's a cooperation and competition component even to hierarchy. And yeah, we absolutely crave it. It's one of the defining characteristics of social interactions, human social interactions, and companies that try to break down hierarchy have had really mixed successes.
When it comes to cooperation, what are the challenges when it comes to trust?
Well, trust is interesting because it's essential for us to collaborate. I need to trust you, and it allows us to reach deals so much more efficiently, to operate more effectively. And yet, trust is also the essential ingredient for exploitation. That is, if I trust you, I'm making myself vulnerable, and you could take advantage of that. And we see lots of cases of people who are too trusting. So a lot of scams are predicated on people being too trusting. They're opening the email, they're replying, they're giving out information. And we might sort of laugh at people for being too trusting, but on the other hand, we really need that trust. That trust is the underpinning of our social relationships and our even our broader economy.
You talk in the book about some red flags for deception. What are those red flags? How do we see them, and ultimately, how do we get past them?
Yeah. So there are a lot of things that we do differently when we tell lies than when we're telling the truth. And we want to look for red flags. And in our book, we highlight a few of them. A lot of them stem from the idea that when we're telling lies, it's more effortful and it shifts how we feel. Now, part of it is we might say things that are different from the actions that we're undertaking. So if our words and our actions sound different or even seem different. So I say, oh, yeah, I'm really happy to work with you on this, but I don't seem that happy when I'm saying it. Or sometimes people will have conflicting signals where they might shake their head no, but then say yes, or they'll pause as they have sort of more in their mind before they say something. It's important to get a baseline. So you want to know, how do people act normally? Because sometimes people are very anxious anyway, so they might be rubbing their hands or rubbing their temples. That's a sign of distress and anxiety. It's a classic sign of deception, but there's some people that are sort of naturally, sort of, you know, tend to do that just normally. Some politicians, like, you know, Ben Carson, for example, he's always rubbing and sort of wringing his hands, which is a sign of anxiety, and it could just be discomfort, or it could just be a natural habit.
Obviously, in the book, you talk about competition, and you point out that often we will get into competitions and rivalries with those very close to us. And I'm curious as to why that is the case. And how do we avoid that and look for the competitions that are important and that we use in the phrase a healthy competition of
right.
What makes it, quote unquote, healthy?
Yeah. Healthy competition can be great. Competitions can be very motivating. The key ingredient here is to think of a competition where I see a path toward my success. If I feel like my path to success is blocked, then that's when it's going to be unhealthy. I'm going to want to just pull you down to my level. So we want to be, you know, I care about our equity. Our sort of relative standing matters to me, And if I can see a way to succeed, that's going to be really helpful. If I see that, you know, I can't, that's when I might turn to unethical behaviors. Now, you mentioned something interesting. The people closest to us are those with whom we're most likely to compare ourselves. So it could be the person in the cubicle next to us or our neighbor. It could be our brother-in-law. It could be a sibling. Those are the people that offer a reference point for how are we doing. So if I were to ask you a question like, how are your kids doing? Do you have a nice house? Do you make a good income? Should you get a new car? It's hard to assess these things in the abstract, and our mind almost automatically races to comparisons. So how's my buddy doing? How's my neighbor doing? How's my college roommate doing on these same dimensions? And those comparisons really, really drive us. They really motivate us. And so it's ironically, it's often with our very closest friends and family members with whom we're likely to engage in these comparisons. And these comparisons can turn us to be motivated in some cases if we see a path toward getting some of those rewards or doing something or working harder for some other reward. Or they can make us perfectly miserable if we, for example, we go on a vacation we thought it was a good vacation, but then we go on Facebook and find out our friends had much better vacations. And we might not be getting a full sample or sort of a complete set of everybody's vacation or other comparison salaries or homes or renovated kitchens. But we sort of look for those comparisons, and that really gives us important information to figure out, hey, how am I doing? But they can shift us from, you know, a sense of sort of complacency or happiness or contentment to a place of being perfectly miserable.
So, in summary, the title of the book is very intentional of not friend or foe, but it's friend and foe, meaning
right.
You ultimately will have both in your life, and you ultimately need both in your life.
That's right. That is, rather than saying humans are hardwired to compete or humans are hardwired to cooperate, I think it's really important, and the central thesis of our book is we're hardwired to do both. We can't escape the reality that we're going to cooperate and compete, and we're going to do it with the same people. So the same people are going to be our friends and our foes. And I think as we recognize that, we could really do better at both. And it's not that we've got to run over our friends, but rather by recognizing that we have conflicting interests, we can actually be better friends and achieve our own outcomes at the same time.
Maurice Schweitzer and Adam Galinsky are authors of the book Friend and Foe, When to Cooperate, When to Compete, and How to Succeed at Both. The book is published by Crown Business. Maurice Schweitzer, thank you very much for sharing with us this morning. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Great pleasure. Thank you. Again, the title of the book, Friend and Foe, published by Crown Business. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.